Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone, welcome to another week of Gee Thanks Just Bought It, the podcast where we talk about what we just bought and what you might need to buy next. I'm your host, Caroline Moss, and joining me today is Maxwell Ryan. He's the CEO and founder of Apartment Therapy Media, one of my favorite places to go and get inspiration, but also to go and feel incredible envy and jealousy. Maxwell, welcome to Gee Thanks.
Thanks for having me. It's glad to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. You started Apartment Therapy as like a newsletter, right? Wasn't it like an offshoot of your design consultant business?
Yeah. I mean, actually, it was more basic than that. I literally hung out a shingle and had a phone number and said, you can hire me to come to your apartment and I will help you transform your apartment in a day. And on no budget or a budget, depending on what you had. And then the email, I started doing a weekly email based on my experience with my clients. And then my brother, who had actually went to business school and had been working in Silicon Valley for 5 years in digital media, he came back on a trip to New York and said, hey, you know, you're writing this funny little email and you're spending a lot of time in clients' homes. You should start a blog. And I said, what's a blog?
Right.
And he said, it's this thing that's really popular and up and coming. And more than that, it's about harnessing the voices of the community. Mm. And that got me hooked.
That is, so you were really early on that blog train. That's early 2000s, like what, 03, 04?
Yeah, I started in spring of 2004, and to be fair, it seems early now, but at the time in New York, I was already becoming aware that there was big sites like Gawker and Jezebel,
right,
and Gothamist and Curbed. They were all going for like a year or two, and they were already gaining a lot of popularity. So I felt at the time like I was late to the party.
Right. I'm sure. I mean, but you're still pre-influencers, pre-Instagram. I mean, in the great.
Pre-social.
Yeah. Yeah. Pre-social media, like in the grand scheme of the timeline, you were probably right around the early side. Because, yeah, that world where it was just, you know, blogspot.com. And
yep.
that was kind of it.
There were three phases. The first phase was you started your site. It could be small, and you started a conversation with your readers, and they put you on their blog roll, right? So they booked.
That's
they bookmarked
right.
You.
The blog roll.
People would go down their blog roll and visit their 12 or 20 sites they loved, mm-hmm. and you would go into the comments and talk to them, and they would talk to you, and they'd send you emails. And I remember I was working with sharing offices with a woman named Meg Hurahan who started Blogger, but she was working for Nick Denton at Gawker at the time. And she had her personal blog, and she would just get packages where fans would just send her things. And it was like this wonderful direct connection you had with an audience.
Yeah.
And then search kicked in, and we all realized that the audience was going to get a lot bigger now because of Google search. And that was driving views, but less connection with readers.
Right.
And then social kicked in, and Facebook in particularly, and that changed the game. It turned the game upside down. And it became at that point almost impossible to keep up with people directly. And now you had to write, you know, you wrote something, you probably had an email and you were tuning it for Google, and now you were pushing out on Facebook and Twitter and then later Instagram.
Right.
And it got a lot more complicated.
Yeah, because we then had to start serving the social media algorithm rather than just writing what we wanted to write for an audience that was there and listening. It all became about like, okay, well, what terms are going to get, you know, are going to show up on the first page of Google when we search, and sort of gaming the SEO. And also like just trolls in general, like back in the early 2000s, like no one would read a blog they didn't want to read. You know what I mean? Or if they did, there was like a, just a small population of people reading blogs they didn't want to read. So you would actually just have like a, even if it was a small community, you would actually have actual engaged readers who were like enjoying what they were reading.
Yeah. They're fiercely loyal.
Yes.
And they were talking to one another. And what Nick Denton at Gawker realized early on, which I'm sorry as it doesn't happen more, it's hard to manage. He realized that the comments were the most vibrant part of a active site. And so they rebuilt their sites, all those sites back then, to highlight comments and also pull commenters up as editors.
Right.
And so that just led to this incredibly active, loyal crowd of people that were really showing up to talk to one another and not just to read the authors, although they were doing that too.
Yeah, I have to remember, but I'm almost positive the Deadspin, a Deadspin editor at one point was just a very active Kinja commenter. I'll have to fact check myself, but like I'm remembering, I'm going back into my memory and remembering, because I'm in like the next generation of blog and internet world people, where like Gawker was already established and BuzzFeed was on the come up and Business Insider, which is where I started working. And, you know, overnight you would get these emails from editors being like, okay, Facebook's not showing photos anymore. Now we have to attach videos to all the links that we put on the Facebook so that like it actually gets in front of the people following our page. And it was just, it's so much to keep up with. And to think that this was less than 20, this was all just in two decades. Is so crazy. It moves so quickly.
You're absolutely right, though. I would say that BuzzFeed, if Gawker and those sites created the environment of commenting and that type of connection, which was really built on the political blogs, political blogs were the first ones to just go bonkers, and they were being a big part of the presidential election of, gosh, way back when. I don't know which one it was, Bush or Gore or any. The when BuzzFeed came along, everyone was like, oh, it's not being smart about what you write. It's about catching the social algorithm just right.
Yes.
So they, you know, they get still get joked for realizing that cute kittens.
Yep.
Kittens work better than like a serious conversation. And they really, they were a technical company. So I knew them too. And they didn't really have any writers. They were just technology. They were a technical team, engineers. And they were looking hard at how to game the algorithm on social. And they figured out that if you got velocity in the first few hours, it was sort of a virtuous cycle and propel you for the rest of the day and the week. And if you could just capture that wave, you would capture the audience. And so they got really good at that. Then they hired writers to write stuff just to put stuff in it.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of it was clickbait at the time early on. But all of that stuff, we started off as writers, then we ended up figuring out how to play like casino gamblers.
Yes.
Having to figure out the system.
Yeah. And I worked for both Business Insider and BuzzFeed. And I can tell you that like some of the smartest people work for these sites. Like, you know, they're not doing brain surgery every day. You can't compare the two jobs. But if you think it's easy to write these quizzes and to be like, okay, well, what can I do that will like get people to both like it and share it and follow and comment, that is not easy. You are competing for so small of an attention span, and you are trying to figure out, well, how can I get your attention and win over my competition, which is the entire internet, all of the streaming sites, your phone, everything. And the fact that these sites can do it is because the people who work there are so smart. And it's more than just like, you're right, like they still get shit for like the cat gifs, but it's like there's a reason why everyone talks about the cat gifs is because everyone was looking at them. Like they're like they did, you know, you were paying attention, you know, and all of those quizzes that are like, you know, you're from Minnesota, when, how many people from Minnesota like put that on their Facebook page and was like, Oh my God, this is so true. There's a whole science behind that, you know, and they're following this sort of mentality of like the content that speaks to you is the content that will get shared. And if it gets shared, it gets in front of more viewers. And then and like it all just is a snowball effect. But it is, you know, the internet just doesn't fall from the sky. You know, people are sitting behind their computers creating all of the stuff that you're consuming every single day. And I think that like, you know, 20 years later after the start, I miss my Google Reader so much. I miss like knowing, you know, I miss going through the line. I read this blog post. Okay, next one, next one. And now it's like, I don't even know where to start. There's so much out there. There's so many videos. All of a sudden it's been 3 hours and I've been watching, you know, like apartment tours. And where has the day gone? But it's amazing to see that apartment therapy is still like really kind of front and center in that world.
Well, thank you. So from that very first beginning, working with people in their apartments, my central insight was if you can help people solve a problem, you will be in business. And so that's, and the business may change in a way, and it certainly has, or the medium has changed a lot. And that's what we're talking about. But the business has stayed the same since day one. And what I tell people I work with is we're not an entertainment company. We do three things. We inspire people. We teach people, and we connect people to resources. And if we do a good job of that each day with regard to home design, cooking, life at home, then we will figure out the medium, but we get to do good work every day. And I think by and large, that's been true. We have been a slow, sometimes a fast follower, sometimes a slow follower of much of the stuff that we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. We have never been on the forefront or in the trade press with breaking, fabulous new technological grounds or being the biggest company or the richest company. But I do think the web now, looking back 15 years, is littered with people who have died along the way. And I'm proud of the fact that we've kept going and we've stayed very true to that. And I think we do a good job. I mean, if you're reading us still, then that's great.
Yeah.
We need to be of service. And if we are, I'm not worried about the future.
You are touching on such an important part of the internet, which is with the speed that everything was moving. I would say between 2008 and probably about the time Trump got elected, there was like an 8 years there where like the internet was really fun and lots of stuff was happening and it wasn't so doomsday every day. Every site was trying to be a site for everyone because everyone was trying to win, like with the most page views, biggest audience. And when you try to become a publication that serves everyone, you end up becoming a publication that serves no one. So sticking to, you know, I wouldn't even call it bread and butter, but sticking to what you came to do is what helps you like outlive the people that, you know, live fast and die young. And I'm on apartmenttherapy.com right now. And I'm looking at the big image and I'm looking at the byline. Kelsey Mulvey and I went to high school together. So I'm like, oh my gosh, right. Kelsey Mulvey, I forgot she worked there. But yeah, apartment therapy like you guys stick to what you know and you do it really well. But I want to touch on something that I said when I introduced you, which is that apartment therapy like ignites a jealousy in me.
Tell me more.
Well, so this is where I'm hoping you'll help me on today's episode before we get into the thing that you brought. What I love about apartment therapy is obviously the aesthetic. Everyone is so like, it's just such a, you know, a well-appointed sort of site that features well-appointed rooms, houses, spaces, what have you. I am a stuff person. I have stuff. And a lot of times when I see pictures of people's beautiful spaces, I'm like, where is all of your stuff? Where are you keeping your things?
Yeah.
And I used to live in a Brooklyn apartment in Cobble Hill that had multiple closets. I think it had four or five closets, which is obviously a huge help when it comes to stuff. But now I live in this house in LA that has two closets and it feels like my stuff is everywhere all of the time, and I cannot get a handle on it. And I was just saying to my husband, I was like, oh, I'm interviewing Maxwell Ryan. And he was like, oh, you should ask him what to do with your office. Because my office is just like furniture and piles. And I want to move out a dresser, but I don't know what to do with all the stuff that's already in the dresser because there's limited closet space. Is there any advice that you could give me that is not have less stuff?
Yeah. And by the way, you know, we wouldn't be in business if we all didn't have this problem to a certain extent.
It just feels like all the people in the picture don't have stuff and all their houses are so beautiful. Yeah. And I'm just jealous.
Especially on Instagram. I sometimes tell the Instagram team, like, where'd you get those pictures? Those are way too nice.
Right. Right. What's happening behind the camera? Like on the other side? Like, it's crazy.
But we do a lot with, obviously, with before and afters. We do a lot with, we now run 4 cures a year where we work specifically with decluttering and cleaning up and stuff. And we deal with real problems and real homes and our own homes for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And even my weekly video, One Good Thing, is really sort of couched in the basis of, like, I am always struggling to try to figure out a solution for something that's gone wrong. And when I find one, that's one good thing, because it helps solve life's little problems.
Right.
But with regard to clutter, first of all, you're not alone. Everyone does it. Everyone does it.
Thank
and I
you.
Like to say, as a New Yorker, if everyone, all the apartments I went into over the years, if everyone thought that everyone who walks down the street in New York and looks as good as they look in terms of how nicely they're dressed, realized that when those people go back into their home, they're deeply embarrassed most of the time. They would understand New York.
That makes me feel better. I get it. Yeah. Okay. I'm glad. So when I was living in New York, I was among like-minded people. It just feels like, I guess Instagram probably really ruined it for me, but yeah, like there's so much stuff and there's no space.
So this is what happens.
Okay.
Here's my theory. We're primates, and we came early on from a hunter-gatherer background. And I don't think, in certain ways, as like a hunter-gatherer's cavemen, we haven't changed that much. In other words, we grew up in a world where more stuff, if we could keep more stuff close to us, we probably wouldn't die. And we gathered surplus in order to feel like we were in control of our life. And if you take that, probably not you or me, but if you think about people in the suburbs who have a lot of extra space and they have maybe freezers in their garage where they can store up a lot of food.
Yeah.
It's the same thinking. We're very good at bringing stuff into our homes. And generally speaking, we don't like to let go of it because we feel safe with it.
Can I interrupt you and just say that makes so much sense to me, because I would not have considered myself a stuff person until midway through the pandemic. And I wonder if it was like a coping mechanism where I was like, you know, there was nothing else to do. So it was like things. and I think you're probably right. And also we all know that when you get more space, you fill it up.
Yeah.
That's so interesting that you say that. That's such a different perspective. Okay. So we are, this is within us. This is part of our biology.
Yeah, so this is within us. And by and large, the world, that was the right way to live in this world up until maybe 100 or 150 years ago. When you move into the industrial period and stuff becomes easy and cheap. In the old days, people used to get their furniture. You didn't go buy a dining room table. You got it from your parents when they passed away, or they gave you that and you kept it in the family for years. And there wasn't that much stuff in the world. You really couldn't. You couldn't have a clutter problem in 1850. It just didn't exist.
Sure.
But now in our world, we know with Walmart and Target and Costco and all of the ways in which it's easy, relatively easy to gather stuff from small stuff to expensive stuff, we tend to over nest. We tend to bring stuff in. And what we do not do well is push stuff back out. And so what I talk about with people I work with a lot is developing that understanding that we're really good at bringing stuff in. So now let's get really good at bringing stuff out. And if we do a good job, we can keep the door, the revolving door going. It's, you don't have to not buy anything ever again. And you don't have to live with nothing. And you don't have to throw everything out, but you do have to figure out a nice equilibrium. And
Yes.
so there's a couple of things that I do that I've taught people that I find work really well. And I'll tell you one really quickly.
Okay.
So decluttering maybe your office is an issue like this. It's really hard to declutter, say, an office. Why? There's two problems. One is you're not sure if you really want to, you can live without that thing. That's one problem. That's one decision thing you have to make. The other problem is you don't know if you decide you don't want to live with it, where are you going to put it? You're going to take it to
Right.
Salvation Army? Are you going to put it in the garbage? Oh, you can't put it in the garbage because you got to recycle. Okay, then I got to do that's another trip. So you've got these two twin decisions being made at the same time. And most of the time, and I live this too, is it's easier to just leave it on the desk because I can't. If I solve one, I don't know the other, and I get paralyzed and I put it back. So what I tell people to do, and typically it is useful to choose maybe once a season, a room in your house, whatever is driving you crazy. You go into your office, you spend in a couple of hours, and you take all of the things that you think you can live without, and you put them in a corner, or you put them in a by the front door, you put them in a box. I call it the outbox,
Okay.
and you just leave them there for a week. And I guarantee you, it's the most fascinating thing. If you that separation anxiety people have with an object, if they know it's just going to go to a box by the front door for a week, and they can bring it back, they can bring it if you want at the end of the week, you want to bring it back, that's fine. Every single time by the end of the week, they look at that box and they go, "What was I thinking?"
Huh.
And it all goes out. And then it's in a box and you take it to whatever. And to be fair, and I probably shouldn't go on record for saying this, I throw a lot of stuff out.
Okay.
Or I put it on the street. In New York, I can put it on the street. I had a pair of shoes that were brand new that I bought and I was regretted it and they just didn't fit. And so I just walked out and put them on the street and they were gone. So you can do that in the city. There is recycling and Salvation Army, but a lot of the Salvation Army doesn't take a lot of the stuff that we want to get rid of
Yep.
because they recognize they can't. So you end up throwing stuff out or giving it away, but it does make it easier to separate with things and declutter. Because really what you're dealing with are two decisions that are too tightly joined and you can't make them at the same time.
That's very interesting because, Marie Kondo swept the nation, swept the world. I don't know, 2015, and her whole thing is, pick up every single item in your house and ask if it brings you joy. But when you're in the mindset of I have too much stuff, nothing actually brings you joy because this is it's a very non for me anyway. It was a very not joyful process. Like the entire idea that I had to do it in the first place brought me no joy. So actually, like sitting down with each individual thing, I felt like I couldn't like the only emotion I was assigning to it was just like being annoyed. I like the idea of. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I hear you. The nice thing about Marie Kondo is that she really pushed people into a positive space, or at least it felt simple to say, does it give me joy? And I think as a messaging, as a communicator, she was genius. But to your point, you should then have basically taken half your office away because
Yes.
none of it gave you joy, but you couldn't do that.
Right, because I was like, I don't know if I'm not feeling joy towards this item, or am I just not feeling joy towards this process? But I like the idea of doing like a purgatory moment with stuff and being like, it's here if I need it, but I'm going to be honest with myself at the end of this week or 2 weeks or however long I give it in the box. How many times do you have to do the box cycle? Is it something that you continuously are doing?
I do it. God, I mean, I do it when I get really annoyed at something, and I feel like I have a little space and time. And it's usually a weeknight, a quiet weeknight when I'm not. And actually, COVID was good and bad. When COVID hit, I cleaned out my basement. It was fabulous. I hadn't done it, and I attacked years 2 years of clutter. But then as COVID went on, things started to fill up. And last was it last night? Yeah, last night we decluttered the refrigerator. And that may not sound like a big deal, but we were pulling frozen meat out of the freezer, looking at the dates, and it was all spring 2020. We were
Totally.
buying stuff in bulk, and it had been in there for over a year. And yeah, we had to throw it all out. So the fridge was really driving me crazy. So that happened last night. I don't know when the next thing will happen, but it tends to have little waves, and then I just go for it, and then I build a little box and leave it downstairs, and then I look at that box all week long, and I'm like, ugh, what am I gonna do with this
Who
stuff?
needs it?
And I, yeah, and where am I gonna put it? And I eventually I you know I tr often try to give stuff away. Some of my friends think it's very funny that I'm constantly gifting them stuff that I'm trying to get rid of and declutter their own house. And then I end up, if I'm in the city, I can put it on the street. That works well. But then again, unfortunately, clothing and stuff, if it's old clothing, I put it in the trash.
I think that well, I will give you a piece of advice if you'd like it.
All right.
Some of the new fa like the fast fashion places who are the H&Ms, the Forever 21s of the world, and I know you have a teenage daughter.
Yep.
So she can let you know, but they do a lot of they get a lot of flack, obviously, for creating clothing that just kind of whips through the world and ends up a lot in landfills. So they a lot of them have started these recycling programs where you can just bring a bag of clothes no matter what condition, and they do textile recycling. So
Oh.
in New York, yeah. So now you don't have to. I totally get it. Dropping off, there's nothing worse than dropping off a bag. And as someone who used to sort donations at
You?
a nonprofit, oh, go ahead.
I had a friend who did was a picker and a sorter. So you did that too.
Yeah, I
I've heard.
did. Yeah, I worked at a nonprofit that did workwear for women who were recently out of incarceration and going back to work. And a lot of times it's just kind of insulting the things that people donate. And, one of the things that we would tell potential donors is if you wouldn't just be say to your friend or your sister, hey, I don't wear this anymore. Would you like it? Then don't give it to these women. Don't donate it. Don't give us, shirts with holes in them. Who's able to use that? It's the same thing bringing it to Goodwill, because it's ultimately going to end up in a landfill. But a lot of these fast fashion, and I know the H&M on 5th and I think 19th used to do this. They have a whole box and they do textile recycling. So that is a tip next time you do a box of clothes. But I think
You know,
you're. Go ahead.
for the record, my 14-year-old is actually much better at this than I am. I'm unfortunately a little bit of a dinosaur, and I get frustrated and I give up. But she's so hip to vintage right now, and into actually she's trying to sell her stuff back on pop something
Poshmark
pop.
or Pop or Depop. Yeah.
Yes,
Yeah,
exactly.
the
Yeah.
teens are
So
cool. This is a very cool generation.
yeah.
And yeah, unfortunately, I feel not kindred with them. I'm like, okay, I'm old compared to you guys. But yeah, it's I think you're on the right track by saying I'm not going to bring this to Goodwill because it just becomes someone else's job, right? I mean, it becomes someone else's weight on their shoulders. But I think the thing about parting with and when I look at apartment therapy and I see these beautiful, clean, and I know a lot of it is, for the photography and we're not getting a total look at a house in chaos. But there's something so appealing to me about having this kind of aesthetic, and I understand that that means, parting with things or not, having as much and but being able to marry the two ideas has always seemed, I always got really stuck on that. And so I think I'm going to try this box idea.
Try
It's,
the outbox. Yeah,
I will.
it's really satisfying when you do it, because it allows you to say, you know what, I'm going to dive into that closet and rip it all out, and it's going to go neatly in a box for the week or two, and then I'll worry about that then.
Yeah. And then
And
we will be honest with ourselves when we come back to it. Yeah. I think especially during the pandemic when everyone became deeply intimately familiar with the four walls of their house or their apartment. Uh-huh. It just, it really kind of, and I don't, I'm not like hoarder status. Like, I'm not living in piles, but like, you know, you always have one room or one corner of your house that like is the excess place. It's like when, yes, you know, a thing doesn't have a place, it goes over here. And then, you know, once a month you get really annoyed with it. And I feel like during the pandemic, it was like sort of inescapable because you were constantly met with that vision every day. It's, you weren't going on vacation. You weren't spending a lot of time outside your house. And you really wanted to make your house comfortable. And I feel like I was able to do that with different spaces in my house. I love my living room. I love my bedroom. But my office and my kitchen somehow, you know, for two people living in a house, we have like 47 plates. And I love all of those plates. I don't think I need 47 plates. We are two people. The max amount of people we have at our house is like maybe six more people. Maybe it's time.
Yeah. You know, you say plates and I don't know what they are, but I'm guessing they did you get them from your parents or anything like that, or wedding presents?
Yes. Like, so I inherited my grandmother's dish set. It is so sentimental to me. My grandmother had six children and 17 grandchildren. So there are a million plates, a million bowls, a million of the small plates that no one ever uses. And then when I got married, we got some really nice dishes. So it's kind of a mishmash of things. I can't get rid of, I feel like I can't get rid of the grandma stuff. But also part of me is like, what if I just kept like two of each like thing in the set? And, you know, maybe I don't need 14 flower plates from 1967. I don't know.
Do you like using them? Do you love them when you use them?
I do. It reminds me of them. I feel, you know, it's very sentimental to me. It reminds me of my childhood. It reminds me of their home, which is no longer, you know, it's owned by another family now. So it's a nice memory. But again, there's just so many. And it's just, you know, if I have that conversation about every single thing I own, I'm a sentimental person. I could be like, oh, this pen, this is the pen. This is the pen that I, you know, I signed this thing with, and then I'll never get rid of anything. You know, I think I need a little tough love. I really do.
Something like that. I mean, the pen I'm not worried about, but the dishes, I totally understand.
Yeah.
This is what I would say.
Okay.
You only need one set of dishes, and you should probably aim to have only one set, and you should use them all the time. Unless you have tons of room and you have a staff or something.
I don't.
Most of us don't. Right. So then you have a problem, because really what this is a family heirloom on a certain level.
Yeah.
And this is just a little story that I love that I remember every time when I feel like I have this problem. So my aunt, my mother's sister, inherited my grandmother's library. And my grandmother's an English teacher in New York City. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very valuable library. It was sort of her personal, her life was wrapped up in those books, and my aunt had it. At a certain point, she realized she had been moving around LA and carrying this library, which was no small thing because it was like hundreds of books. It was expensive, it was heavy. Every time that she moved, she had to build out a new room for it. And she realized, I think in her 60s, that it was a weight that was bringing her down in her life. Mm. So this is going to be the dark side of Marie Kondo. She realized that she wanted to lighten her life, because she wanted to be light before she died. And so she wanted to just let go of the weight she was carrying in life, so to speak. And she went through this exercise of looking around her at all the things and giving them away. And the main thing was this library. And what she did is she went to all the family members. I have a few books, and she gave us pieces of the library that she thought we would appreciate. And then everything else that she didn't keep herself, which is a small portion, she gave to a library. So it went to a library.
Oh.
Now, you can't exactly do this with dishes.
Right.
But I don't know if you have siblings.
I do.
But if you want to use that set and make it your daily set, then do that. But if you don't, and you have, I don't know, regular everyday white plates that you prefer to use more often, you might consider giving it away. And keeping it in the family, but giving it to someone who will use it, or maybe splitting it up. I don't know. You tend to not want to split dishes up.
That's actually
But
a nice idea. I like the idea of maybe just calling up all my cousins and just being like, does everyone want one grandma plate? And I think I
yeah.
would be okay without the set, because I have the set from the wedding and my wedding, and you know, the plates, you know, they appear at the top of the plate pile in the cupboard when they do, and we don't really care about matching or whatever, but I would like, you know, to have one, or maybe a backup one if it breaks. See, this is how my mind works. Like, I'm a nut. I'm like, well, I have to have, like, you know, two extra. But I think that might be like a nice, yeah, these are things like I haven't, and honestly, I should have done before we moved all of our stuff from New York, you know, 10 years in New York to Los Angeles. But you're right, and I'm remembering packing all of my books up and my husband's books up to move, and that was the most expensive part of our cross-country move, was just boxes of books, and then they take up the whole house. And, like, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, we're the house with all the books, and sometimes I'm like, oh, we're the house with all the books, you know. And it's like, there's an emotional, I just think, yeah, I like the idea of knowing who has, you know, the things that are sentimental to me but that are just not necessary. And I think it'll just
I
require some thought, and, like, you know, a couple, like a weekend of, like, you know, really taking some inventory and figuring out what makes sense.
Yeah, I think, and particularly for things like that that are hand-me-downs, if you're on the other side, let's say you're on the other side, and you've now reached out to your cousins, had a really sort of sweet connection with them, whereby you've distributed this sort of incredible family collection in a manageable way, and now you've A, done all of that good work, and B, your cabinet is not brimming with 47 plates. And you have one or two, which is totally fine. I think that would feel better in by leagues than holding on to the set and no one knowing where it is and only you knowing the value, but it's too heavy even for you.
Yes, I really like that. I think this was like a very good ther this was a good apartment therapy session. And I'm realizing too that I think a lot of these behaviors skip generations, because when my grandmother died and my grandfather had already passed away, you know, my mom and her siblings that lived in the area were really in charge of cleaning out the house. And of course, my grandmother was, you know, a depression kid, and, you know, they didn't throw anything away. You ate the crackers that expired 3 years ago. You would never throw out, you know, a box of crackers. And that's just sort of the way she lived. And it was one of those things where she'd go to the grocery store, even in her 70s and her 80s, and if they were doing like a 10 for 10 pasta deal, she'd get all 10 boxes. And my mom would be like, "Hell, you are one woman. You are one. Why are we buying 90 boxes of pasta?" Well, they were on it was a good deal. And so I think my mom is so the opposite. My mom is always, every time I call my mother and she lives in New York, she's throwing something away. I'm like, "What are you doing?" She's like, "I'm cleaning this thing and I'm throwing everything away." And I think she kind of wants, she doesn't want to have, she doesn't want us to have that experience that she had with her own parents' house, you know, when it's her turn. She just wants it to be easy for us. But I think I took on more of the characteristics of my grandparents, which is like, I save everything. And I think it's because my mom, like, if she could, would like get one of those big dumpsters in front of the house, and we would have one couch and four plates and maybe a dining room chair, and my mom would be so happy. Like, she would just light the thing on fire. And it's just, you know, the mentalities are different, and sometimes when you have a really extreme, when there's a spectrum and you know someone on the really extreme side, you end up going to the other side. And I think that, like, some of that behavior is totally in the family. But you're right, I don't need 47 plates. And I know deep down in my heart I don't need 47 plates. But it's just, you know, it's work, you know, like cleaning all this stuff out, like years of just, like, you know, memories and things that you attach a lot of sentimental value to is sort of a task that I think a lot of people avoid, myself included.
Once you do deal with this part of it, though, I think what I found is you become a lot more careful about what you accept as a present or anything. I now get cards. My mother was a little bit like your grandmother.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So yeah, I'm a little bit of the declutter. My mother's house was very pretty, very pretty. Mm-hmm. She was an artist, but she every surface was covered with something pretty. Wasn't clutter per se, but it was a lot of objects.
Right.
And she wouldn't let go of anything. Mm-hmm. Although it was very nicely curated. And I think what I found is I used to get, you know, you get holiday cards, and actually probably we get less holiday cards now than we used to get when people sent paper, but you still get that sort of stuff. And they used to sit on my desk, or, you know, put them on the bureau for like a month, 2 months, 3 months. You'd be like, it'd be springtime. You're like, can I throw out that beautiful photograph of my friend with their children? And
right.
On the, you know, and you, oh no, I can't do that. Now I receive the card. I make sure I read it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it on the desk. And at the end of the week, I put it in the garbage. And I've found there's like a, once you realize how valuable your life is and how much weight possessions can put on you, mm-hmm. you become a lot more careful about buying and also receiving stuff that people give you. And it's a good practice because it means you don't have to declutter so often.
Yeah, I really like that. I really like that, having that hard and fast rule. And I think my mind always goes to like, but what if this person dies tomorrow? And then I'll want their Christmas card forever. But like, when has that ever happened to me? Not ever. And probably won't happen often if it ever does. But like, I have like a shoebox of like birthday cards, you know, from like, I don't know, my aunts and uncles. And I just feel bad about throwing them out. But you're right. I don't know why I like have that. And of course, they're like, I know exactly where all of them are. They're on their little spot, like in the coat closet. And it's not invasive to my life. But I'm also like, you know, why is this here? And what am I doing with this? And what's going to happen to me? What's going to really happen to me if I throw this away? And I think I'm coming off as more of a hoarder than I am. I'm really not. And you would never know by looking at my house that I just have, I've accumulated more things than I want. But I think it's the, like, you know, the really kind of taking yourself through that thought process of like, you know, what is it about this that I'm keeping? And especially now that we all have phones, I could take pictures of the cards like, and that would be fine. And then they're taking up no space. But there's something that always has felt bad to me about, you know, throwing away a birthday card. But you're right. It's like, you read it, you laughed at the joke that Hallmark made, and you sort of fulfilled the life cycle of what a birthday card is supposed to be. You know, you don't have to keep it forever.
No, more than that. And I think this is really important. Here's the real therapy side of it. When someone sends you a birthday card, they're sending you a little piece of their energy that they want you to receive through the card, with the writing and you know, their personal writing or a joke they've chosen, or and signing their name, love your friend. And what we need to get good at is receiving the energy of the card and realizing it is not in the card.
Mm. Yeah.
So take the energy, say thank you to your friend, even if they're not there. Say, you know, really receive the card. And then the paper and the photograph and the writing is not important.
Right. It's been transferred to you and it's done its job. I really love that. That's great.
Same is true with gifts. I mean, a lot of people... God, I mean, one of the worst times is when people have a baby and then they get a lot of baby shower presents.
Right.
And they can often be overwhelmed. And that, again, is a time to receive the present, the goodwill,
mm-hmm.
and do not get buried in the stuff. Give it away, recycle it, return it to the store, whatever you need to do. But if we just realized it's the energy we need to exchange, and we did not see stuff or materialism as really having energy in it. In fact, it's actually, there's a wonderful book about feng shui and Decluttering by a woman named Karen Kingston. She's English. And I read this years ago and it made a huge impression on me. She said, dust in the house, when you dust a house, dust is dead energy.
Mm.
It's the particles of dead energy. And so for a energetic house, you want to keep it clean. You want to take out the dust for sure. But you also don't want to get surrounded by clutter, because that is ultimately dead too. The energy is going to pull you down. So we need to focus on the energy, focus on people, real living people, our friends, our family, and the stuff. We don't need that. We don't need half as much as we have these days. And certainly 100, 200 years ago, we lived with a lot less.
Yeah. I find this incredibly helpful, and I'm going to email you once I have an outbox in my front little hallway, and I'll let you know how I'm feeling. I really appreciate that advice. It's great advice.
I'll send you, I made a little video for One Good Thing about the outbox, in which I do it myself, which is always fun.
Yeah.
I can use my work to actually clean out my house, which is pretty great.
That's great. Perfect.
I'll send that to you later on too, as well.
I would love that. And now I'm so excited to know what you brought to G-Thanks Just Bought It. I know you had sent two options.
Oh my God.
And one of them flagged to me as like, okay, we need to talk about this. So let's hear it. What did you bring to G-Thanks Just Bought It?
Actually, after this whole conversation, now you've hit my problem area, because I'm very good at clutter, but maybe because I have a daughter, I just got way into fun things.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of collected practical jokes. and I arguably have, that's my clutter problem, but this one takes the cake. So it was literally about 3 weeks ago, and I had a friend staying with me who was from Jamaica, and it was a really hot day, and we have a pool in the backyard here, and kids were about to jump in the pool, and she said, "Oh, you should have a foam party." And I said, And I had no idea what she was talking about. And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "In Jamaica, the hotels I've stayed in, they have foam parties." And she quickly pulled up her phone, Googled foam party at Jamaica, whatever. And all these people were in their bathing suits standing surrounded by like a huge bubble bath of foam, but it was outdoors and it was like an acre wide. And they were all like sipping drinks. So I said, "Where do I get one?" Of course, being as I'm a good at this as I can be, I go to Amazon and I put in foam machine, and one popped right up.
Of course.
And I looked at it and I said, "If I click buy now, this will come in 2 days." And it came in 2 days, and I bought a foam machine with a foam sleeve, and it does, and all these packets of surfactant that you mix with about 10 gallons full of water.
Okay.
And then you take one tube. The foam machine is basically a big fan, but it's a fan that pulls up a combination of water from your hose that goes into a little nozzle and this tub of surfactant mixed with water. It's basically soap, which is also dermatologically tested, doesn't hurt anything, disappears. It's totally non-safe, non-toxic. And it pushes it through this fan, and it starts to make ginormous foam that very quickly spreads across your lawn, across a beach, or across your pool, so much so that you can't even see the water anymore. And then you jump through it for hours. You jump in and out of it. Kids love to hide under the bubbles and not come up. And then the wind will kick up and lift these bubbles up into the air, and they'll blow up into the trees. And it's like surreal.
That sounds amazing.
It's really fun. I don't know. You asked me what I bought. Gee, I bought it, and I have to admit, it was really fun.
This is still fun.
I've used it twice.
And your kid likes it, and her friends like it, and everyone is like, "This is like the cool house with the foam machine."
Pretty much. My daughter's friends love it. My daughter likes to kid me that I shouldn't have bought a foam machine. And she was convinced that all of the foam was going to like pollute and, you know, turn the water in the pool green or something like that. But I read all the instructions and I went through the whole thing. They wouldn't make it if it did all that. So she's let go.
Oh, good. I'm glad. She seems very into sustainability, which I really appreciate.
But she is tough.
I'm glad that it is really non-toxic, because that makes it even more enjoyable. How long after, okay, foam party's over, everyone's inside, we've all rinsed off. How long is the foam staying? Like, when does the foam go away? And how do you, like, what's the lifespan of the foam?
Oh, it's really, it's really soap bubbles. So it lasts, it starts to fade, you know, maybe, you know, 10, 15 minutes after they're made, but the machine makes so much, it just keeps coming that you can keep it going for a couple of hours until you turn it off, and then it'll be gone in about an hour or so.
How long do you have to keep the machine on to get, you know, the whole pool area covered and to make it feel like really crazy? How long does it take?
About 5 minutes.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
Once the machine starts pumping out the foam, it's a little freaky, and that's also part of the joy of the ridiculous purchase, because people go, oh my God, that's a lot of bubbles. Oh no, look at them. And they start to travel across any surface, whatever surface you put in front of it, they're going to just start to spread out all across it.
Wow. This sounds so fun. I'm looking at Amazon right now. I just typed in foam machine. I clicked the first one. Do you remember what the name, which specific one you got?
Yeah, it was no specific brand that I remember, because it was just called foam machine. It was called, I searched for it, and I think it might've been a bestseller.
Okay.
Don't know.
So it was like kind of the top rated. Do you remember how much? Oh, okay. I think I see it.
Yeah, no, here was the only problem. It wasn't cheap.
Yeah.
But it's the Foam Party Super E Foam Machine with Siphon Hose and Foam Powder Pack.
What a name. Okay, let's see.
But it's solid state. It's a completely solid state thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes with everything you need to get going really quickly, and then 12 extra packs. And personally, I sort of thought, this would be not something we would use for the summer, but also I could loan it to friends, because I'm very happy to have them take this over to their house too and share the
Sure. The communal foam machine, what every friend group needs, really, I think. So this was, I'm looking at the price. So it was $695.
Do you see $695?
Yeah. What, does that sound right to you?
Mine is $685.
Oh, okay. Well, the deal on your end. I wonder why.
But no, yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. But you're not buying a throwaway machine. This is a real machine. It's sort of like buying a prop for a set, for a film set.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you look at it that way, you know, you can think about that. I am. This is where I got into trouble with my daughter, because I didn't show her the price, and when she sneaked and she saw the price, she got a irate with me, but I tend to get enthusiastic about certain things, and I have to say, I haven't made any mistakes.
Okay, I believe you for sure. I think if you're gonna buy a foam machine and you're like, you know, we're gonna use it, and this is a thing, we're gonna take care of it, like anything you buy, like we're gonna take care of it, and we're going to, you know, make sure it's stored properly. Then we're gonna share it with people, like. It does make sense. We talk about this a lot on the podcast, you know, buying the quality expensive item over buying the, you know, maybe $90 item that will break and then you'll have to throw away, and then it's just contributing more plastic to landfills. And like, those are all things you want to think about. And I think that like it, if you thought it through and you were like, this is going to be a thing that we have, I think that makes total sense. And it sounds like it actually works, which we've all bought things on Amazon. I think probably like the more inexpensive version of things, it comes and you're like, this sucks. This doesn't work. It sucks. I can't return it, or, you know, and it just ends up in the garbage. And so the thoughtful, you know, higher quality piece of equipment ends up always being the better buy. And I imagine this is the same one they use, you know, in heavy duty, I don't know, films that have foam parties. I'm sure there have been them. I'm looking at all the pictures of the Foam Party Super E foam machine in action. It looks really fun.
It's really fun. It's surprising. Again, I had never seen anything like this before, so maybe that's why I got so taken. But I have to say, in terms of good, clean fun, it's hard to beat.
It's really funny that you brought this. I told you this before we started recording, but in our one of our Patreon episodes, Jackie and I were talking about, you know, the things that we remember about our college experiences, and she went to University of Texas, and she was like, "Oh, foam parties." And I had never heard of a foam party before. We did not have them at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And then when you emailed and said, "Oh, the item I'm bringing is a foam machine," I was like, "Well, this is just kismet. This has to be the item. This is very cool."
There you go. And actually, you know, I didn't do a lot of research. If I do a little bit more, it looks like there are less expensive versions, and more expensive versions, but there are some quicker, like even $170 here, it looks like, at Target, they make a foam machine for pool. So there you can enter at different levels, but I will say it was surprising and fun for adults and kids. And it's just summer. It's just a summer thing. It was really hot a few weeks ago, and it was really fun to think about being outdoors all day.
Yeah, that's really nice. And you know, kids have also dealt with so much in the last, we've put them through a lot in the last year and a half, 2 years of this pandemic. And you know, most of them can't be vaccinated yet, and all of them have been without their friends for a while. And this summer was sort of the return to normalcy for a lot of kids. And so if you can add a foam party
It
to
was,
the
and we're not
mix,
traveling. I
yeah,
know.
exactly. It's your vacation budget.
It's been a little kooky in the last year, and so we have been home all the time. And so I have bought a few toys
Totally.
just to keep ourselves entertained.
Yeah. In that same vein, my husband and I bought last summer because we were like, oh, well, we have no travel budget. Like, there's nowhere to put our travel money now. We bought an outdoor projector and
Oh,
screen
yeah.
for outdoor movies, which was like the best money that we spent because it also allowed us to have friends over, you know, during the pandemic and say, like, you know, keep your
Outdoors.
masks on. Yeah, we're outside. You go around our front yard. You don't have to come through our house. Please, you know, use your bathroom before you come over because we'll make you squat in the woods. But it was like a nice little thing that we could
Yeah.
do to give ourselves a sense of normalcy, and it was worth every penny from that respect.
Yeah, I think that's true for me too. It was a little bit about stocking the house for outdoor playthings that we could. Because we couldn't, even this summer, I mean, it's been a little touch and go, but just being outdoors and staying home a lot, it felt like investing in the home.
Yeah, exactly. And right, just like we were saying when we were talking about organizing, you know, we were faced with like all of the money you would be spending elsewhere, out to eat, experiences, travel. You know, you saw a lot of people who had, you know, that superfluous cash in their budget be like, how can I make this place that I am going to be spending all of my time more comfortable, more fun, more peaceful, and happier because we are not leaving for a while.
Yeah.
And even now, you know, we're far from over, you know, what's happening. And I feel a lot better now that I'm vaccinated, but I still spend more time at home than anywhere else. Well, Maxwell, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on G Thanks Just Bought It. Thanks for all of the wonderful apartment therapy that you gave me. I'm looking through the site right now. It's not anything new to me. I look at it all the time, but there are so many great things that I think listeners will love. If you're not a regular apartment therapy reader, you know, get on board. There is a lot of inspo, and if you're like me, there'll be a little bit of jealousy too, but I think you'll be able to get past it. I really enjoyed having you on the show, and we will link to the foam machine for everyone in case anyone is in the market. I might be now after this conversation.
Well, if nothing else, all I can say is gee, thanks. I just bought it. Thank you,
Amazing.
Caroline.
Amazing. Thanks so much for coming. Everyone, we will link to everything we talked about in the show today, so you can get your own foam machine. I will link to the Outbox video from Maxwell. And if you're someone who's trying to declutter but does not want to hold up every single shirt you own and ask if it brings you joy, I think this sounds like a really good alternative. And we will see you guys next week for another episode.